From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
And then all of a sudden, through the crowd, and it wasn't, you know, one ohm, it was about 400 ohms. I don't mean electricity, you know? So, and it was like, oh my God.
Filmmaker Jerry Aronson on the life and times of Allen Ginsberg. We'll hear more from Aronson today as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the publication of Jack Kerouac's groundbreaking novel, On the Road. Also, we'll explore the jazz poetry of a group called Merge. And beat writer Joyce Johnson talks about her relationship with Kerouac.
Even though he wrote in On the Road that he'd gotten the message, go moan for man, he wanted to moan for man only at the typewriter.
I was traveling west one time at the junction of the state line of Colorado, its arid western one, and the state line of poor Utah. I saw in the clouds, huge and massed above the fiery golden desert of Evenfall, the great image of God with forefinger pointed straight at me through halos and rolls and gold folds that were like the existence of a gleaming spear in his right hand, which saith, come on, boy, go thou across the ground. Go moan for man. Go moan. Go groan. Go groan alone. Go roll your bones alone. Go thou and be little beneath my sight. Go thou and be minute as seed in the pod. Go thou, die hence. And of this world report you well and truly.
It's a clip of Jack Kerouac from his appearance on the Steve Allen Plymouth Show on NBC Television in November 1959. Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road was published 50 years ago, and there is still a lot that book can teach us. According to journalist John Leland, he's the author of Why Kerouac Matters, The Lessons of On the Road. They're not what you think. Leland talked to Steve Paulson about the importance of reading Kerouac's On the Road.
I think it's still an exciting book for us to read. And also, it's a book about how to live your life. I mean, Kerouac wrote this book in 51. It was published in 57, a period of tremendous change in the country. And Kerouac was figuring out how it was he was going to live his life as an adult male in this world. And I think those lessons are still important to us today.
Now, you mentioned there was this long lag time between when he wrote the book and when it was actually published. I mean, he tried to get a publisher and had trouble for years. And then my understanding is that when it was finally published, it took off. It became a bestseller.
He wrote the book and nobody wanted it. You know, every house in New York, every publisher in the country, every significant publisher rejected it and continued to do so for 6 years. You know, people look at Kerouac as a slacker, as a layabout. And Kerouac continued to publish manuscripts during the 6 years that this book was rejected until finally Malcolm Cowley persuaded Viking to publish it in 1957. And then, as you say, it just took off.
So it struck a chord right away as soon as it came out.
Yeah, it got a great review in the New York Times the day it came out and some probably helpful negative reviews elsewhere saying that it was an immoral book or a book about a generation you can't understand. And I think to the generation that felt it wasn't well understood, that resonated.
Now, the reputation that this book has always had is it's kind of the Bible for hipsters. Did it have that reputation right away?
I think the book has always been misunderstood, or at least it's never been understood in the way that the author intended it to. People have read this book as a license to go out and live your life irresponsibly, as a slacker Bible. And yet, it involves tremendous work ethic. And within the book, there's a great spiritual search. But people have always fastened on the search for kicks.
So when you say there's a tremendous work ethic in the book, I mean, as we read this novel, what do you mean?
He sets out at the start of the book, he meets the narrator Sal Paradise, meets the character Dean Moriarty, who's basically Neil Cassady, who's going to lead him on the road. And he says from the start, it wasn't just because I was a novelist looking for material that I wanted to go. And really he is. We're reminded that he is a worker, that Sal Paradise is a novelist working on a novel, and that Kerouac behind that is a novelist working on a novel. And as he's going about these adventures, they're really all his work, and he's doing the things that a novelist does, looking for material, searching for the right voice in which to tell his story. And there were work role models out there at the time. You know, it's the time of the organization man and the corporations. And he's looking for a different model of kind of an old-fashioned productivity model that he can aspire to.
It's so interesting to hear you say this, because the way this book is usually interpreted is that it celebrates the freedom of the open road, of living spontaneously, breaking rules and expectations, and being true to yourself.
What Kerouac did was mesh all of those things with the idea of being productive. You know, Kerouac's not a child of the 50s and 60s. He was a child of the 30s and 40s. He grew up in a blue-collar mill town of Lowell, Massachusetts. He joined the Navy and the Merchant Marine. He really believed in those, you know, 30s and 40s, a man is measured by what he produces, not by what he consumes or how he manages a company. So he had to be productive in the way his father, who ran a print shop, was productive. And if you look at Kerouac's journals, they're punctilious about how many words he wrote today. Only wrote 500 words today. Worked really well. Wrote 1,500 words on this. As if he's talking about laying bricks or, you know, producing furniture.
Now, I can see what you're saying about Kerouac himself and how hard he worked to become a successful writer. But do you think that message, that work ethic, is apparent in the novel itself?
I think it's behind the novel. No one comes away from the novel thinking, gee, I want to go out there and work really hard. But yet the character Sal is working on this novel. He publishes another novel in the course of the story of On the Road. But there's also a sort of a conventional family story in the book as well.
Now, one thing that I find striking about what you're saying is that you're really shifting the focus to the narrator of the story, Sal Paradise, who is Kerouac's alter ego, whereas most people tend to talk about the more colorful character, Dean Moriarty, who is based on Neil Cassady. Why are you suggesting that we should really talk about Sal Paradise?
Well, like any good book, there's at least two or three stories within On the Road. And the captivating one that has astonished people over the years is the story of Dean Moriarty. And he is, you know, a wild character out of the West who leaves behind damage and babies and philosophy everywhere he goes. But the guy telling us the story, who's with us every word and is controlling how we see all these things, is the narrator, Sal Paradise. And he's the one who's growing over the course of the novel, doing the things that we need a novel to do. He begins by being infatuated with Dean. And at the end of the novel, he's in New York and Dean is in California. And Sal is looking over the continent at Dean. And he doesn't really need Dean anymore. He doesn't need Dean to show him the road. He's carved his own life. He's now with this woman who corresponds with Kerouac's second wife. And he's, you know, in a stable family situation, or at least so Kerouac thought at the time.
Doesn't he really reject Dean Moriarty in the end?
He feels that they will always get back together, but he is no longer dependent on Dean in the way he was earlier in the novel. And there's a key scene when some of the women in Dean's life chew him out and say, you know, you're nothing but an irresponsible, no-good fool. And Sal sticks up for him, and he feels that that's where their relationship changes. And he suddenly recognizes that he's the older character in this relationship, and he's going to be really taking care of Dean. And it's kind of where Sal finds his voice in the course of the novel, and where the novel finds its direction.
So you're really saying that this is a story of Sal growing up, of Sal maturing in a way that Dean Moriarty never really does.
Dean is fully formed at the time the novel starts. And in fact, one of the first things we learned about Dean was that he was born on the road, that his, you know, parents gave birth to him between Salt Lake City and Denver, I think. So Dean exits the novel basically as he entered it. But Sal begins the novel with the sense that everything is dead and his life needs to change. He's recovering from the breakup of his marriage, and his father has just died. And the first line of the novel, as it's published, is he talks about the marriage breaking up. The first line of the novel, as he originally wrote it, was he was recovering from his father's death. So he's kind of on his own, and he's got to find his way and figure out who he is. And by the end of the novel, he does that.
And yet Dean is a tremendously attractive character, especially for someone like Sal, who's grown up in a kind of a safer environment. But to see this guy out here who's a bit of an outlaw, who's stolen cars, who lives the wild life, who's not going to just buckle down to what you're supposed to do. And I mean, the consequence of that is, you know, he doesn't shoulder the responsibilities that he really should. But you can see why generations of readers have been so drawn to Dean.
Dean is a great character. I think the 60s grew up in Dean's image. And in the 70s, the same people suffered the consequences of that. But it's also Sal's book. And the important thing about the book is that the back and forth within that. I mean, it's really a wonderful portrait of a friendship. And if we only see Dean within the friendship and the love that Sal holds for him, and we don't see Sal's growth in it, I think we're missing a dimension of the book.
Now, how do you think this book is read today? I mean, you're suggesting that the real messages that come through are not what people tend to think. I mean, it's not really just about the sort of freewheeling, shuck all responsibility, but it's something quite else. But I mean, do you think people actually read it that way?
I think most of us still read it for the sheer joy of the language and the sheer music of the language and that sense of possibility that we're not tied to, you know, whatever it is that we're doing at the time, but we can leave that behind us, reinvent ourselves in some ways, perhaps on the road, but perhaps without leaving home. But it's that sense of that there is a possibility for us to do greater things and do them in the company of our peers.
Is this a book that you have come back to over the years? I mean, does it resonate for you personally?
Well, I think like everybody, I read it when I was 17 or 18 or 19, loved it, inspired by it, and put it down forever, looked at it through those 17-year-old or 18-year-old eyes. For other reasons, I picked it up not too long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and reread it and started to see different things in the novel. And that made me want to learn more about Kerouac and find out how this novel fit into his life.
I mean, obviously, you found new things in there, but was it still meaningful to you, or was it meaningful in a different way?
It didn't have that kind of pop song release that it had for me the first time. You know, the first time you hear it, it's like the first time you hear the Rolling Stones, and wow, is that exciting, and you cannot believe that there is that much, you know, power and sexuality and just thrill in the world, noise in the world. But coming back to it as an adult, it was interesting to find that there was structure layered upon that story and that there were lessons within it, and that it was a guy grappling with questions of, you know, who am I and why am I here and what am I doing, that we all really do grapple with. And as an adult, you realize that those aren't questions that you grapple with only when you're 17, but you grapple with throughout your entire life.
So in the end, you're really suggesting this is a very grown-up book.
There is a grown-up book within it, and it is a book about, you know, it's a book of the 50s, and the nation was captivated with this idea of adolescence. And this is a book about how to adolesce, how to become an adult, how you're going to deal with love and sex and work and identity and your family and your friendships. It helps you through all those things.
John Leland is the author of Why Kerouac Matters, The Lessons of On the Road. They're Not What You Think. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
I live in New York, 1949. Gold calls the country, out of airplane time. Montana, in the cold, cold fall. Found my father in the gambling hall.
Joyce Johnson won a National Book Critics Circle Award for her book Minor Characters, a beat memoir. The book was originally published in 1983. It chronicles Johnson's life as a member of the Beat Generation and her relationship with Jack Kerouac. Joyce Johnson spoke to Anne Strainchamps about her Beat memories. Johnson started by reading an excerpt from Minor Characters about how she met Kerouac. It was 1957. The phone rang. Allen Ginsberg answered it and told Johnson that someone wanted to speak with her.
Hello, I'm Jack. Alan tells me you're very nice. Would you like to come down to Howard Johnson's on 8th Street? I'll be sitting at the counter. I have black hair, and I'll be wearing a red and black check shirt. I'm standing in Elisa's kitchen holding the phone Alan has just handed me. It's a Saturday night, shortly after New Year's. Sure, I say. I put on a lot of eyeshadow in my coat and take the subway downtown to Astor Place and begin walking westward, crosstown, passing under the bridge between the two buildings of Wanamaker's department store and the eye of the giant illuminated clock. It's a dark, bitter January night with ice all over the pavement, so you have to be careful. But I'm flying along. It's an adventure as opposed to a misadventure, under which category so far I've had to put most of the risky occurrences in my life. The windows of Howard Johnson's are running with steam, so you can't see in. I push open the heavy glass door, and there is, sure enough, a black-haired man at the counter in a flannel lumberjack shirt, slightly the worse for wear. He looks up and stares at me hard with blue eyes, amazingly blue, and the skin of his face is so brown. He's the only person in Howard Johnson's in color. I feel a little scared as I walk up to him. Jack, I say. There's an empty stool next to his. I sit down on it, and he asks me whether I want anything. Just coffee. He's awfully quiet. We both lack conversation, but then we don't know each other, so what can we say? I'd like to tell him I've read his book, if that wouldn't sound gauche, obvious, and uncool. When the coffee arrives, Jack looks glum. He can't pay for it. He has no money, none at all. That morning, he'd handed his last $10 to a cashier in a grocery store and received change for a $5. He's waiting for a check from a publisher, he says angrily. I say, look, that's all right. I have money. Do you want me to buy you something to eat? Yeah, he says, Frankfurters. I'll pay you back. I always pay people back, you know. I've never bought a man dinner before. It makes me feel very competent and womanly. He has Frankfurters, home fries, and baked beans with Heinz ketchup on them. I keep stealing looks at him because he's beautiful. You're not supposed to say a man is beautiful, but he is. He catches me at it and grins, then mugs it up, putting on one goofy face after another. A whole succession of old-time ridiculous movie comedian faces flashes before me, till I'm laughing too at the absurdity of this blind date Alan has arranged. The notion of Allen Ginsberg arranging blind dates will crack people up years later when they ask me how on earth I met Kerouac. As for what he saw in me that night, I'm not sure at all. A very young woman in a red coat, round-faced and blonde. An interesting young person, he wrote in Desolation Angels. A Jewess, elegant, middle-class, sad, and looking for something. She looked Polish as hell. Where am I in all those funny categories?
You began by paying for his meal, and there were an awful lot of years or times when you did act as a kind of caretaker for him, especially, I guess, maybe after On the Road came out?
When On the Road came out, it was very hard for him to deal with the sudden huge change in his life. Suddenly he was not only famous, he was notorious, and it happened to him literally overnight. It was a complete reversal. There was so much attention, it was scary. The fans were avid to know him, to make contact with him. There were a lot of critics attacking his work. Most of what he said to reporters got sort of twisted around. It was profoundly upsetting to him.
You have a very funny scene. In fact, I think it's literally the morning of the day that the big New York Times review of On the Road came out and a reporter shows up. I wonder if you remember that scene at all.
I do remember that scene. The Times review had come out just the night before, and we went back to my apartment. In the morning, the phone started ringing, and Jack's publisher arrived with a reporter and a case of champagne. During the course of the interview, a lot of champagne was consumed because Jack—that was the way Jack could deal with meeting reporters and dealing with the public. He'd have to get drunk in order to do it. He was basically very shy. And the reporter was asking him all these questions that were sort of, I thought, very annoying questions. I was eavesdropping on the whole thing, you know. Do you think America is going to go beat? You know, what's going to happen to our young people? I mean, the reporter, like a lot of other people, thought that being beat was about a kind of juvenile delinquency for older people. And Jack very patiently tried to explain the meaning of beat, how really it was that he had derived it from the word beatific. And, you know, it meant to Jack and his friends originally that you were sort of beaten down to the bedrock of consciousness, but looking up and out for more experience.
There was a kind of ecstasy to it.
And there was a kind of ecstasy to it.
But the reporter wasn't getting this at all.
He wasn't getting this at all, and he was just like a lot of other reporters. And it wasn't very long after that that Herb Kane, out on the West Coast, came up with the term beatnik, and the whole idea got very debased. It was sort of became a kind of code word for a kind of crazy lifestyle that involved bongo drums and berets and sunglasses and, you know.
Suddenly, I think you write that, you know, couples in the suburbs were having beatnik parties with their friends.
That's right. That's right. Once in a flea market, I came across a, you know, a do-it-yourself beatnik kit. It contained a goatee, dark glasses, and a beret.
Oh. In the meantime, there you were, the woman in the background who was kind of holding Jack Kerouac together through all of these events. And, you know, as more and more people wanted a piece of him and as he began to kind of disintegrate, you know, there's scene after scene in which you're the one ending his appearances saying, Jack, we got to go. Jack, it's time to leave, you know, before he pretty much crumbles. Were you really the one sort of holding him together during some of that time?
I was trying to hold him together as best I could, but it was a pretty hard job. Just the, you know, the prospect of getting him home and up four flights of stairs safely was kind of hair-raising.
Was it galling to you then? I imagine it must be some today to think, you know, here you were, the woman in the background, not seen as a talented writer in your own life. I mean, one of the big criticisms of the male beat writers today is that they were misogynistic. Would you say that was the case?
Well, you have to remember that I was so much younger than Jack, and I was just beginning to write. So I didn't have that feeling that people should be paying attention to me. I was struggling with my first novel. In fact, Jack used to tell me, you know, don't be like me, don't revise, first thought, best thought. But of course, I couldn't do that. So, you know, I revered him as an older, incredibly gifted and experienced writer. He was sort of a mentor of mine. I accepted that role. Also, you have to remember that the 1950s were a terribly misogynistic time. And in the arts, it was generally felt that women couldn't really produce anything important or worthwhile. It was just sort of an idea that was sort of spread through the culture. You know, when I went to Barnard College, which is a women's college, I was an English major. We studied only one female writer. That's unthinkable right now. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very different scene for women. Jack, I have to say, in contrast to other men I met, took my writing very seriously and was very encouraging.
You know, he's still such an American icon. Looking back, what do you think is the biggest misconception people have about him?
I think people over the years have confused him with Dean Moriarty in On the Road, who was, you know, based on his friend Neil Cassady. And Jack was always quiet, withdrawn, reflective, very much an observer, even though he wrote in On the Road that he'd gotten the message, go moan for man. He wanted to moan for man only at the typewriter. I don't think he envisioned being a spokesperson for a generation. That wasn't what he wanted at all. He was also a weird kind of mystic. His beliefs were a combination of the Catholicism of his childhood and Buddhism.
So it's been 50 years since On the Road was published, and there's still an extraordinary amount of interest in the beat movement, more so now because of the anniversary. But why do you think there's still so much interest in the beat movement?
I think that the message of the beats is still very potent. You know, the message of the beats as opposed to the message of the beatniks, that feeling of being open to experience, of not being materialistic, of trying to find out who you are. I mean, that's a very potent theme for young people, and I think it always will be.
Joyce Johnson is the author of Minor Characters, a beat memoir. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps.
I'd rather be thin than famous. I don't want to be fat. And a woman throws me out of bed calling me Gordo. And every time I bend to pick up my suspenders from the Davenport floor, I explode loud, huge grunto and disgust everyone in the familio. I'd rather be thin than famous, but I'm fat. Paste that in your Broadway show.
Jack Kerouac with I'd Rather Be Thin Than Famous, chorus number 104 from his poem Mexico City Blues. Steve Allen accompanied Kerouac on piano. Do you have any special memories of reading Kerouac's On the Road or any other works of beat literature? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, the life and times of Allen Ginsberg and jazz poetry as we continue our celebration of the 50th anniversary of Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Jerry Aronson spent a dozen years filming the great beat poet Allen Ginsberg. The result is his documentary, The Life and Times of Allen Ginsberg. The film was originally released in 1994. A revised version was released in 2005. This director's cut is available as a two-DVD set with newly updated and unseen footage. Jerry Aronson told Steve Paulson about the first time he met Allen Ginsberg. Aronson was taking photos at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
Within 5 minutes, I was in the midst of a chaotic riot scene. There was tear gas everywhere. There were police chasing kids around. They had taken their badges off so they couldn't be identified. They were swinging clubs. It was incredible chaos. And I was taking a lot of photos, and I didn't want to take any photos of anyone being hurt. And at a certain point, since it was an old camera, of course, film, not digital, I had to bend down to change film. And as I was bending, changing film, I had this feeling sort of something happening above me. And I looked up and there was a policeman standing over me with a club, and he was about to club me hard. And he had a real hateful look on his face. So everything kind of went into slow motion almost. And then all of a sudden, through the crowd, and it wasn't, you know, one ohm, it was about 400 ohms. I don't mean electricity, you know? So, and it was like, oh my God. So everybody froze. And being younger than the policeman and lighter, I ran. And I looked back and he looked down and I wasn't there. And as he started to chase me, another student tripped him and he fell. And I ran towards the ohm as fast as I could. It still took 20 minutes to get there. And there was this bearded guy sitting in a circle. And there were about 300 people sitting around him, all ohming. They were surrounded by about 500 policemen who didn't know what to do. It was a really almost absurd scene, and I think it's in the film, actually.
And it turns out that this bearded guy was Allen Ginsberg.
Well, yeah. So there was this bearded guy, and it took me 20 minutes, roughly, to get up to him. And I said, "Hi, who are you?" And he said, "I'm Allen Ginsberg." And I said, "Oh, I'm Jerry Aronson. How do you do?" And he goes, "Well, great." And I said, "Thank you." And he said, "For what?" And I said, "Well, I think for saving my head." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Well, I'll tell you sometime. Thanks again." And I left thinking, wow, what a cool person this is, you know?
So you spent a lot of time with Ginsberg, I mean, both physically in his presence, talking with him, but also just living his life again in a way. I mean, was this a man you liked?
Yeah, it was extraordinary. I got to like him because I got to see who he really was. And he was honest above all. His poetry there was no question I had to ask about who he was or what he believes in or who he loved, because it all came out in his poetry. So in the film, if you noticed, I snuck in 12 separate poems. Of course, Kaddish and Howl, but also 10 others, just because, well, Alan called that his concert footage.
He was a performer. I mean, he knew how to perform these poems in public.
Exactly. I mean, I had read Howl finally, and I was having a hard time reading it because I didn't realize the lines were that long, you know? Mm-hmm. And then when I heard Alan read it, it was the breath he had developed as a poet. A line could take a minute and a half to be really perfect, and he would read it with one breath for a minute and a half. And then that's when I filmed him reading it, and I realized the power of that poem.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night.
When I finally realized also, at least from my point of view, that his poems were most important and had the most meaning when he read them. Mm-hmm. Because he, other poets, of course, you can read and get your own feelings and meanings out of them. But Alan really understood what he was writing, and then when he read it, the true meaning came to all of us.
You know what really struck me as I was watching your film and watching him read some of his poems is how different some were. I mean, Howl comes across, to me at least, as a very angry, frenzied poem, a sort of poetry as an explosive act, whereas Kaddish, which is his poem about the death of his mother and reflecting back on his mother's tragic life, that's soulful. I mean, that's kind of a heartbreaking poem.
Strange now to think of you, gone without corsets and eyes, while I walk on the sunny pavement of Greenwich Village, downtown Manhattan, clear winter noon, and I've been up all night, talking, reading the Kaddish aloud, listening to Ray Charles Blues shout blind on the phonograph, the rhythm, and your memory in my head 3 years after, and read Adonais's last triumphant stanzas aloud, wept, realizing how we suffer and how death is that remedy all singers dream of.
Again, that's sing, part of, I think, remember, why he was such an amazing poet, because he could read and write the feeling that he was feeling, and then he would deliver it in that way. And yes, he did perform, exactly, you're exactly right. He performed his poetry. And again, it was his concert footage. Mm-hmm.
Now, early in the film, Allen Ginsberg talks about how he inherited a lot of his poetic paranoia from his mother, Naomi, who had a hard life. I mean, she'd had a nervous breakdown. She was institutionalized for her mental illness. How much do you think Allen's relationship with his mother shaped who he became as a person and as a poet?
Well, I think his mother had an extraordinary influence on it. I mean, first of all, of course, she was his mother. So there's that, for a young boy, that's one of the most important people, if not the most important person in your life. And so her behavior, which was so erratic, I mean, one day what was right, the next day was wrong. So there was really no consistency in his upbringing at all. It really was extraordinary how hard his life was and how he survived. I mean, really, for me, the story is Alan the survivor. And the first person he survived and learned to deal with was his mother. I mean, his father left, his brother went off to the army, and there was Alan, a 13-year-old child, and this woman who was manic depressive and schizophrenic. So when she was in institutions and he would go to visit her, she would grab onto him. And in fact, when he's reading Kaddish, I have a moment there where he explains what happened. And there's a photo, a beautiful photo of her with her arm around him, and Alan's saying, look at the grin on my face, this 13-year-old boy not knowing what to do.
This is in Greystone State Hospital, actually, in a very plain plaid dress, I think, given out at Greystone or brought to my mother to keep her looking normal. And she had her arm around me. I was holding onto it. She looks a little doubtful about the camera, and actually this probably was in the middle of a conversation in which you were saying, Alan, take me home. And I wasn't in any position to take anybody home, trying to keep up a good face. So I think this photograph would probably be at the heart of Kaddish.
And so you realize how hard it was, and at the same time, how amazing he was to have survived all that.
Well, and not only to have survived it, but, I mean, he retained, as far as I could tell, an enormous amount of affection for both of his parents. I mean, given all of the trauma he had with his mother, and then with his father as well, who was a poet himself. And, I mean, it would have been easy for Allen to reject his father. I mean, sort of, you know, he was the old school kind of guy. But he kind of, even when he became an enormous celebrity, he was the good son.
Yeah, that's his father's new wife, who became Allen's stepmother, Edith. And if you notice in the film, I featured her a lot because Edith, to me, was kind of the angel of the movie. She accepted everything. She accepted Allen in all ways. She loved Allen. And his father was different in the sense that he was a different kind of a poet. He was more of a classic poet, more of a rhyming poet. And so he and Allen would argue about their styles of poetry. But when it came to really respecting each other, there was really a great amount of love there. Even though Kaddish was written for his mother, when his father passed away 10 years later, Allen wrote that whole series of poems, Don't Grow Old, and then finally Father Death Blues, which is a really beautiful blues song about death. And he sang that on the Dick Cavett Show.
Hey, Father Death, I'm flying home. Hey, poor man, you're all alone. Hey, old daddy, I know where I'm going. Old auntie death, don't hide your bones.
Kaddish was written 3 years after his mother died, and he has a line in there where he says, now I can talk to you, now that you do not have a mouth. So he's, you know, the poem again is sort of his therapy for him to deal with all the things that had happened. But also, I think also the way his mother behaved taught him about the problems people have and how you have to learn to deal with those issues. And finally, I think it's what helped make him survive, because he did survive, but more than survive, you're right, much more than survive, he went on to become somebody who really tried to help the world in every way possible. So I think he learned, you know, from his mother that that's what you had to do. And he also learned from his father, you know, that disagreements on an intellectual level really have nothing to do with one's emotional life.
What was it that surprised you the most as you got to know Ginsberg and his life?
Whoa. That's a good question. Because I can't say nothing. What surprised me the most?
Mm-hmm.
I'm about to send it to Sundance, but I have to do one more thing. And that one more thing was to show it to Allen Ginsberg. He never said you had to.
Mm-hmm.
But in my own mind, if this was going to be the gift I wanted it to be, I wanted him to say it's okay, it's good. Because if he wouldn't have liked it, I wouldn't have sent it, and we would have either changed it or just dropped it. So I decided to show Allen the film, brought him to my house, popped in a VHS, put him on a couch in front of the TV, angled a chair so that I could watch the TV and his reaction at the same time while he was watching it, and we started it. And he sat there the whole time, cross-legged, kind of, you know, smiling and nodding, but not at anything specific, just at the whole kind of film as it moved along, kind of almost like a meditation. And when it was over, nothing, not a word. And I, at this point, I think I was having a major panic attack, okay? And it's like, okay, so finally it's like, Allen? Yeah. What did you think? Silence. Looks at me calmly and goes, so that's Allen Ginsberg. And, you know, it's like, what does that mean, right? So I go, yeah. And he quiet again, and then he goes, okay. Okay. And it's still, I'm like in shock, you know? So I'm like, okay. He goes, okay. So I think that's the payoff right there to the whole, your question. I mean, you know, that was the biggest surprise and the hardest moment, I think, in making the film.
This man who had never been at a loss for words, you know, when he sees his life created in front of him, he doesn't know what to say.
Either that or, I don't know. You tell me. I mean, I had no idea. I still don't to this day.
Father Breath, once more farewell. Birth you
Allen Ginsberg performing Father Death Blues on The Dick Cavett Show. It's an excerpt from Jerry Aronson's documentary, The Life and Times of Allen Ginsberg, which is now available as a special 2-DVD set. Jerry Aronson spoke to Steve Paulson. When you think of jazz poetry, images of Jack Kerouac reading and David Amram providing musical accompaniment probably bebop in your head. But there's a group today that is keeping this beat tradition alive and putting their own unique stamp on it. The group is called Merge. Coming up, we'll meet Merge as we conclude our Hour on the Beat Generation and the 50th anniversary of Kerouac's On the Road. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Merge is a quartet that combines poetry with jazz music. Musician and composer David Amram sees the similarities between Merge and his own work with the Beat Poets. Amram calls Merge an exciting and highly creative new collaboration. Cassandra Cleghorn and Eric Lawrence are half of Merge. Cleghorn is the poet, and Lawrence plays saxophone and flutes.
Dust, dust and ash, that's all you are, reads the note I carry in my pocket.
Of course, jazz poetry goes back a long way. The 1920s is often spoken of as the earliest time when jazz poetry was out there, very different from this. But for most of us, I think jazz poetry is almost integral with the Beat Generation. You talk about that, Eric, as something that you paid attention to. Is it the biggest influence on Merge's work?
Well, I would say for this particular project that we're doing now that would be true. But I would say that Beat poetry is no more a big influence on the ensemble that we've created than bebop is to the music that we play. It's a type of form that came before us that informed what we do, but we're not direct descendants of it except for in a very, very specific and pure sense of the inspiration, which was that it was when David Amram and Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg were doing this in 1957, David was listening to them and he was responding to the stories that they were telling. And he was playing those stories on the piano or on the French horn or whatever he was playing. And that's still what we do today. And I think that's why David has become our fairy godfather and our biggest supporter, yeah. You know, because he sees that there's a direct link to this that doesn't necessarily happen in people who are trying to recreate beat poetry with music.
Of course, Amram is quoted as saying that your group merges another step forward in celebrating the marriage of poetry and music. Do you see it that way? Cassandra, do you see this as a marriage? Do you see that what you're doing with poetry and with Merge is like what Kerouac did with Amram?
In spirit, yes. I mean, the thing that's really inspiring to me about Kerouac and Amram and any number of the guys who are collaborating, and it was mostly guys, in the late 50s, my favorite example is Kenneth Patchen's work with Allen Ferguson. I don't know if you're familiar with the Beat Generation collection that Rhino Records put out in 1992, but there's a very short 1.5-minute piece by Kenneth Patchen, the poet, called The Murder of Two Men by a Young Kid Wearing Lemon-Colored Gloves, which is a delicious, pure example, the best, I think, of the interplay between poetry and music. And in that case, Allen Ferguson, who was a chamber jazz composer and arranger and musician, composed a piece that just absolutely in gloves that poem. And the poem is just a series of repetitions of the word wait until the last word, which is now. You really have to hear it. It's really phenomenal.
Wait. Wait. Now.
You can hear in our new album that one of my favorite moments is about 30 seconds or so into a blues that I do, which is a tribute to the great blues and R&B violinist Papa John Creech. Mm-hmm. It's called The Fiddle Man. The guys start out with a blues and I jump in there with my poem. There's a kind of a brief pause and I'm about to repeat a line, I think, or about to repeat a word, and the trumpeter, Stephen Bernstein, just inserts a note right in that pause, right after my word, just before I'm going to say the next word. And you can hear me smile. I barely can hold it together. And we were going to change it, and Eric's like, it's too perfect. It's too much the spontaneity, you know, of that session. And so we retained it. It must have been when Papa John sang, "Gimme an hour in your garden, baby, and I'll show you how to plant a rose." Yeah. It was when Papa John sang, "Gimme an hour in your garden, baby, and I'll show you how to plant a rose."
You've been talking a little bit about some of the things that are on Mystery Love's Company, Cassandra, but there's one that I was listening to. We stopped in the unimaginable darkness.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me about that?
I also teach American literature at Williams College, and this year I decided in my intro to American literature to teach On the Road, and I hadn't reread it for many years. I was really reading it with an ear toward the music of the language this time around and thinking, gosh, is there anything in here that I could read and kind of own, you know, as a reader and as a poet? I said to Eric, you know, maybe we should do a little bit of On the Road at Naropa. And so I picked this one passage that I really loved that takes place in the Mexican jungle toward the end of the novel. Eric and I did it just as a duo at Naropa. And when we went into the studio, I said, let's open this up. Our recording engineer, John Guth, is also a guitarist and a percussionist, and he had a beautiful Chinese drum called a hong.
Actually, it's Swiss.
Oh, is it Swiss?
Yeah, it just sounds like
it. Sounds Chinese. Sorry. It's Swiss. It's this beautiful thing. It looks like a, what do we call it?
Like a giant flying saucer.
Flying saucer, yeah. It looks like it.
Like if somebody took a flying saucer and turned it into a steel drum.
Yeah, it looks like like a double steel drum. It looks like a big lozenge. And it sits on this, sits on this wooden stand, and it just resonates. I mean, if you've heard the piece, you know, it's just a gorgeous sound. And so Eric played the flute, and John played the hong, and I read this passage, and Renee Hart, our bassist, did beautiful work on the bass, and it was just this kind of magical improv.
Lying on top of the car with my face to the black sky was like lying in a closed trunk on a summer night. For the first time in my life, the weather was not something that touched me, that caressed me, froze, or sweated me, but became me. The atmosphere and I became the same.
There's a few ways that we construct our pieces. And one is that I will sit with a poem of Cassandra's and then I'll create some music around it so that it creates the atmosphere that I think that the poem is speaking to me. I think I'm very fortunate in that I can sit down and read a poem, and I know Cassandra's poetry, some of it, where it really speaks to me very quickly and very directly. And then other times, we had this process in the studio with our first CD, where with some of the poems, we purposely didn't try to come up with a preconceived notion because we wanted it to be spontaneous. And we're a group of really wonderful improvisers, and that's why those people are chosen. But what we would do is, quite simply, Cassandra would read the poem, and then without really talking about it or mentioning keys or tempos or anything like that, we would just go right to our instruments and we would play it. And from the way that she read it, we would hear the tempo, we would hear the intensity, we would hear all the basic elements that need to be in a classical composition, which is basically what you're listening to, which is chamber music in its purest sense. In the purest definition of chamber music, it's separate entities playing different parts without a conductor.
Parting the curtain, I see no movement at all. Doubtless, I will know his walk.
Two responses that we get quite often, which are basically the same response. People who are more literary based will say, it's really hard to listen to the lyrics because the music's so distracting. And the music people will say, the music is really great if you can only get her to stop talking, or something like that. No, that's an exaggeration. Well, one person did say that, but he was joking. He was a friend of ours. And you get that a lot. Or one woman actually just very honestly said, you know, I really love your CD, and next time I think I'll listen to the words.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. That's my favorite way. Yeah. Next time I'm going to listen to the words.
I will deny until the day they heave my ashes into space that mass doesn't matter. That in an airless chamber, and anything and a feather will always fall in tandem. I asked you before politely, but now I need to know now. Where did you put the lever that plumb upended me?
That's Merge with Unearthed, a selection from their forthcoming CD, Mystery Loves Company. Cassandra Cleghorn on vocals, Eric Lawrence on saxophone. If you're interested in finding out more about Merge, you can find a link to their website on our website, ttbook.org. This is music from Merge's self-titled debut CD. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 99A, The Beats Go On. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Thanks to special guest engineers Brad Kohlberg and Tom Blaine. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.